Solidarity Not Charity is proud and honored to have as our guest today Andrew Mangura of Kenya. Mr. Mangura is here in Florida as a participant in the month-long African People's Socialist Party School that is going on in St. Petersburg currently. And so we want to thank you for joining us today, Andrew Mangura. We want to also right away let our listeners know that there are two events that you will be speaking at coming up in St. Petersburg on April 13th at 4 p.m. at the Uhura House on 1245 18th Avenue South, and then on April 15th in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania at 7 p.m. at the Uhura Solidarity Center, 3733 Lancaster in Philadelphia. The title of both events is Black President Doesn't Equal Black Power, and it will present an analysis of the recent turmoil and struggle in the elections in Kenya, a country that the U.S. long considered one of its most stable neo-colonies, and we'll discuss the election campaign here in the U.S. as well. And here in St. Petersburg, you will be joined by Cherno Alpha Mba, the director of the Africanist Movement. So we're looking forward to both of those events and want to encourage our listeners to attend in order to hear more from Andrew Mangura as well as Cherno Alpha Mba. So greetings, Mr. Mangura, and thank you for coming on our program. We'd like to start by asking you to talk a little bit about your life. Where in Kenya did you grow up?
I'm from Mombasa. Mombasa is a coastal town, or you can say the port city. And that is the second largest port city in the Western Indian Ocean region. The first one in Durban in South Africa. And my life in Mombasa, I can say that I've been a human rights defender since I was born. Because they say when I come out from a womb of a mother, I started crying. So Mombasa, as you can see, most people know about Mombasa. Mombasa has been there, port Mombasa has been there. Seafarers have been visiting Mombasa port 500 years before Christ.
Can you tell us, we have listeners throughout the U.S. and of course in Europe and in Africa as well, and probably especially the ones listening in the U.S. where we're kept pretty ignorant about what's happening in Africa, may not know anything at all about Mombasa. Can you tell us a little more about the history of where you're from and what the conditions are today and some background on the area?
In the outset, you can say Kenya, not Mombasa alone, Kenya's all is peace. But we do understand there's no peace in Kenya since 1904, when the British signed agreement with Maasai and local people to lease their land for 99 years and for 909 years.
999
years. There are two types of lease, land lease in Kenya. One 99 years and the other one is for 999 years.
Under what circumstances was the lease agreement made?
When the white men came to Kenya, they came there like missionaries. That was Church Mission Society of Africa, Church Mission Society of Britain. And then when they went back, they come back as first they were explorers, the Portuguese, and then they came CMS, Church Mission Society. They came as missionaries, and then they came back as British men, as a businessman. And the business company was known as Imperial British East Africa Company.
Okay. And what was their interest in the region of Kenya?
You know, Mombasa alone has been a business, international business, since the 10th century. Doing business with Arab merchant traders, Mala Arab slave traders, Asians, and some peoples come from far away, like the Chinese. So Mombasa is a business town. So when the white man came, he went interior to areas like Uganda and mainland Kenya. And the business was to, from mainland Africa or mainland East Africa, it was ivory and natural resources to foreign countries, okay, and slaves. Mm-hmm. But the Imperial British Company, East Africa Company, they were not there for business of slaves. Their business was natural resources, ivory, and other things. So British Imperial British East Africa Company then was given, I can say, it was recognized by the British government to overlook or to see or to control or to administer, as you can say, business government business in East Africa. That's part of Kenya, Uganda, and mainland Kenyan part, but not the coastal part of Kenya, because the coastal part of Kenya was under Sultan of Zanzibar.
So, at the period when you were growing up in Kenya, what period was that, and what influenced you in your political development, or what, can you say more about what the conditions were?
I grew up during Kenyatta time.
Okay.
Because I was born after a colonial era, after independence.
Okay.
So we grew up and says a Uhuru country, we are free, but we weren't free at all. When Kenyatta came into power, he wasn't part of the struggle. Kenya has been out of the country since 1946, I think. For 16 years, I've been away in Europe. He wasn't involved in power struggle. He wasn't involved in the struggle of our country or in freedom. He wasn't part of the freedom fighters at all.
So, as you were, we do definitely want to talk a bit more about Jomo Kenyatta and the Kenya Land and Freedom Army. Before we do that, can we just get a little bit more background about you? Because you're, you've been very active in the issue of the seafarers and the maritime activities around Africa. Can you say a little bit about how you came into political life, or what were your influences as you became politically active?
Okay, when I grew up, I went to school, mission school, as the rest, because you can, to study, you have to go to a mission school, as the other peoples. And then in 1978, Kenyatta died, Moi came into power, Moi, Daniel Arap Moi. And Moi was more brutal than Kenyatta. So we, as the student leaders, we ran away from the country to foreign countries. I went to Tanzania and others went to Sweden. Some of them are still in Sweden. In Tanzania, I joined the Dar es Salaam Maritime Institute under a system of the NORAD. That's a Norway organization. Okay. And they offer assistance for me to study further studies as a marine engineer.
I
took marine engineering in the Dar es Salaam Institute, Maritime Institute, and then I went to sea for about 9 months, and then I came back when it was quiet. And that's for about 4 or 5 years out of the country. When I came back, things were not good. I ran away back to Tanzania, and then I went to South Africa. In South Africa, I got the opportunity to work for the PLAN, that's People Liberation Army for Namibia, as a journalist. They did have a newsletter. So there were one thing to do: take a gun, join the guerrilla war, or take a pen and write. So they gave me a pen. I started writing on behalf of my Namibia freedom fighters. I was stationed back to Tanzania because there were so many Namibians taking training there, going under military training. So my part was to write what is happening in the forest and what is happening at Swaziland. That was my job. That's where I started coming up on doing something on international or African freedom fighting, not for Kenya only, but for other parts of Africa.
So early on, because you were forced out through political repression in Kenya, you began to take a more Africa-wide, worldwide African view.
Yeah. And by that time, they were those which were known as frontline states. And frontline states were Namibia, Angola, Mozambique, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. By that time, it was known as, North and Rhodesia.
And that what was it like being a part of that struggle during that period?
That time, we can say it's somewhat backward, because by that time, there were no internet, no mobile phone. Just you bang on your call typewriter, what you have to bang, and send it out. So when it cooled down in Kenya, I went back to Kenya again. I joined a ship. Most of my ship were foreign ships, because they cannot be employed in Kenya. Because I'm blacklisted.
Because of your employment activity
I'm a troubleshooter.
Okay.
Troublemaker.
Yeah.
I'm a troublemaker. So up to date, I'm blacklisted. So I work at sea for about 18 months, that 1.5 years. The way I saw things, because I was outside of my country, I saw different what is happening in the country and outside the country. So I started mobilizing the seamen to come up and do something as a union leader.
Where did you travel when you were working on the ships?
I've been for more than 47 countries.
Okay.
More than 7 countries.
Mostly throughout Africa or in other parts of the
Atlantic world? Africa region and India Africa region, Mediterranean, Pacific, and as far as France and the North Sea. Because I worked with the underwater exploration ships, salvage companies.
Now, when you were a student and then you went into working as a journalist in the frontline states, were there particular leaders or theoreticians that influenced you in regards to the struggle for African liberation? Were there particular political influences that molded your thinking towards the liberation of Africa? Or was it primarily from your immediate experience and what you were seeing, or did you have theoretical influences as well?
I didn't have theoretical influence by that time, because, as I said, we were in the dark. We didn't know what is happening.
Okay.
So you do what you think and what you see or what you hear.
Okay.
And you do what you think is right.
So you began to organize the union of the seafarers.
Seafarers Union in East Africa. And then by that time it was known as East Africa Seamen Union, because I found it there. But I wanted to change it to be a modern seamen union. Because I've been to so many parts of the world asking workers, how much do they pay you? They pay at this much. And you, how much do they pay at this much? So we wanted to make it as not to pay East African the way they are paying them. Like now, I'm preparing a document for East African seafarers working on board EU fishing vessels to be paid as what it's worth in the European Union, not at what is worth in the East Africa region. Because East African seafarers are being paid $120 per month. But ILO says that the minimum salary must be
559. That's the EU Union demand.
The ILO says that.
The
ILO, International Labour Organization.
Okay.
So we are pressurizing with our friends in Belgium, we are pressurizing the European Union to change. Either pay 559 or more than 559.
So the ships authorized under the EU, they pay one rate if you are African, and they pay a different rate if you are European.
Yeah, that's what they are doing. But according to our friends from Belgium, Brussels, they send us the right agreements, EU agreements. So you want them to be paid as per EU agreements,
right.
Not pay them as per African agreements, Kenya agreement. Because we know East Africa has got no fisheries policy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no proper agreements according to as per East Africa governments. So we must now. I'm working aboard EU flag vessel. Pay me as per EU flag agreements or EU labor rights or labor laws.
In addition to the pay, are there other working conditions that you're addressing?
Yes, living and working conditions poor. Are poor, very poor.
Can you describe what it's like to for African working on the ships?
Africans are being overworked, not on only on EU fishing vessels, but on all. You go even if it's a local shipping company or international company, they're being underpaid and they work over 8 hours a day and they work under terrible condition, I can say.
What type of ships? What are the purpose of the ship? Is it primarily cargo or?
Mainly cargo and fishing vessels.
Fishing, okay.
Cargo and fishing vessels. Oil tankers. Some of them work aboard the oil rigs, oil platforms, not fishing vessels. Oil platform.
The what?
Oil platforms.
Platform. Yeah. Okay. So now you are here in St. Petersburg, attending the school of the African People Socialist Party. How did you meet the Uhuru movement and the APSP?
I met them in the UK when I was there to give a talk on maritime security and safety of the coast of the North Horn of Africa and West Africa region.
Okay.
That's where upon I met them. That was in 2006.
Okay. And what made you interested and you became involved with the APSP and now you're in St. Petersburg? Why?
As I told you earlier, I'm part of Kenya Socialist Democratic Alliance based in Scandinavia. These are former students who ran away from Moi government and we form an organization out of the country.
Yeah.
So while I was in London, my friends in Scandinavia told me about the Africa International Solidarity. Africa Socialist International.
Yeah.
So I emailed to them, asked them if I can see them or where are they stationed in London, because I'm visiting London. I'll be there for about 6 months. So quickly, Louise replied, and we make arrangements. We came down with the papers, documentation, and some posters of Marcus Garvey, and I told him, I know Marcus Garvey, I know this man. Because we hear reggae music talking about Marcus Garvey and Che Guevara, because we know Che Guevara. So that's where I started involved with the. So this is what we belong. This part of us. Although we have a different view from what we know about Che Guevara and Marcus Garvey.
You say you have a different view, or what?
We learn about Che Guevara and Marcus Garvey through reggae music.
Okay, yeah.
Listen to music. But here there are papers, documents and books.
Okay.
And DVDs, you know.
Yeah.
So Louis said, you take it to Africa and give your friends the true picture of Marcus Garvey and true picture of Che Guevara.
Now, when you learn the Uhuru movement, of course, for our listeners who are probably aware, Uhuru is the Swahili word for freedom, and it has a history in Kenya. Can you speak about the significance of the word Uhuru in the Kenyan freedom struggle?
Uhuru is a Swahili word meaning freedom, and it's not used only in Kenya, but it's being used in all Swahili-speaking countries. That is Zanzibar, Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi, southern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Comoro Islands. Wherever the Swahili-speaking people, Uhuru means freedom. And Uhuru, it was a call, I think so, a sign call for Mau-Mau fighters to give them go forward. Is somehow called freedom for Mau Mau. They use that word, Uhuru, and you respond motto.
Motto.
Motto. Uhuru, you respond motto.
What does
motto means? Fire.
Fire.
Don't give up.
Yeah.
Don't give up. Uhuru, motto. Don't give up. But it is a Swahili word, means freedom. Mm.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the history of the Kenyan Land and Freedom Army and the struggle for independence in Kenya?
Okay, the as I said earlier, in sometimes back 1904, when the European Union, the British, started signing those lease, 99-year lease and 999-year lease, that's when Maumau came in. And Maumau, they were fighting for our, I think, central part of Kenya. That's where they come from, near Mount Kenya. And where they, and that's where the European took big part of land, and Maasai land also. And Maumau were not only Kikuyus. Many people were involved in Maumau, were part of Maumau.
Which other people besides
this? These were Maasai, the Luos, Taitas from the coast, where white man took the land.
Okay.
They joined Maumau. Before Maumau, there were rebels. There were rebels or uprising before Maumau, long time ago, in southern part of Tanzania. Because when the white men came there, they came to East Africa. There were Germans and Britons and Friends. Germans took southern part of Kenya, coast of Kenya and Tanganyika. And the Britons took the Kenyan mainland up to Uganda. You see? So those people where the white men took the land joined forces. So in the coast region, they were coast part of Kenya, they were Mekatilili is a woman. He rebelled against the British. She rebelled against the British. And the coastal part of Tanzania, they were Maji Maji rebel. I think you heard about it. They rebelled against the Germans and the Hehe rebellion also. And then Maumau.
So are you saying that the Maumau was across, beyond Kenya as well?
No, not beyond Kenya.
In
I mean
Kenya, but
Kenya
the different groups.
Different groups. The but majority were Gikuyus, Merus, Embus, and some tribes of Kenya, Kenyan tribes, like Luos and Maasai.
So they began in the early part of the you say 1904, in the early part of the century.
No, for a long time they began fighting, took up guns in the thing in the year 1949. Well organized now, because most of them came out from Second World War. Whereupon they got they got a lot of experience, military background, training on how to use a gun.
Because they had been employed by the European powers to fight each other?
Yes, they were fighting on behalf of the British,
yeah,
under the Kenya King's African Rifles, KAR.
Okay.
King's African Rifles. They went to Burma and other parts and to fight the Germans,
yeah,
British against Germans.
Right. And then, so they became well organized in 49, having gotten the military experience out of World War II, and then developed into unified political organization fighting for independence of Kenya.
Apart from experience, the one thing that annoyed them most is that when they came back, those officers, of whom were them, the white men, when they came back, they were given high posts, government posts, as district officer, district education officer, district this, permanent this, provision this, you see. So they were not happy with that. Say, no, you came back, I was with you at the forefront fighting, but I've got nothing. You have my land, you have everything. So they went the bush to fight that, because they were not happy with that.
The white officers were given high government position after the war.
And they were also given land.
And land.
Mm.
So, as the struggle developed with the Maumau, or the Kenyan Land and Freedom Army, can you describe what happened as the day came close for independence for Kenya?
By that time, we were informed that 40,000 people lost their life, that is Kenyans. And in turn, Maumau killed about 4,000 or 2,000 Britons, 3,000 Britons. These were officers. And those Africans who were killed, they were not killed by the white men. Some were killed by the Mau Mau, being as traitors. And one of them was a chief, an African chief. African chief who accompanied Kenyatta. When Kenyatta came from Europe, the African chief took Kenyatta to Kirigiti Stadium, that is in Kiambu district, Kenyatta's birthplace. They called a general meeting, gathering, public rally, to curse the Mau Mau. And Kenyatta himself, he also cursed the Mau Mau. So people saw that Kenyatta is a betrayer. He's a traitor. So people were not happy with Kenyatta and the chief. The Mau Mau eliminated chief. They were looking for Kenyatta, but Kenyatta, luckily, he disappeared. And people were not happy with Kenyatta because Kenyatta had a chance. Because Kenyatta was just a carpenter when he was young. And he joined Nairobi Council, Municipal Council, as a meter reader. So the Kikuyu Central Association gave him opportunity to go to Europe to study. Because they believe because most people by that time were not educated. And they trust that when he comes back, he's got a lot of education. He can talk with a white man and talk to represent people now, land fair. But when Kenyatta went to Europe, 16 years, came back and he changed. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was against the Mau Mau.
Can you tell us about the leader of the Mau Mau, Dedan Kimathi?
Oh, Dedan Kimathi, leader of the Mau Mau was General Mathenge. Second in command was Dedan Kimathi.
Okay.
But Dedan Kimathi was more tactful and more, I think Dedan Kimathi was the best than Mathenge in warfare. But Dedan Kimathi, General Mathenge is still alive up to date. He ran away because it is said that he was the one who betrayed Dedan Kimathi.
He was the one
on the left. He betrayed Nakimathi. That's what he said, General Mathenge, and he ran away to Ethiopia. Up to date, he is in Ethiopia alive. About 76 years old, I think, now.
In addition to having the organization of the armed struggle, the Mau, did they have political principles or a platform that they were basing the movement on?
Yes, they didn't trust political parties. Because they say, why you sit down talking, waste time. The one we sent to Europe to study and to talk with the white man, he came back and he betrayed us. Let's take a gun and fight the white man. So they didn't believe in politics.
So it's fundamentally get the land back.
Land and other things also, not only land. Freedom. Equal rights and justice.
Yeah.
You know, the word Mau Mau means that Mzungu aende Ulaya, Mwafrika apate uhuru. Mau Mau is a short form of M Mzungu E aende U Ulaya, and the other Mau Mau is Mwafrika apate uhuru. White men go back to Europe so that Africans can be free. That's the word Mau Mau, that's the meanings of Mau Mau.
Okay. That's beautiful.
You know, also Kenyatta, while in detention as a political leader and seven others, he signed or endorsed hanging of Dedan Kimathi. He is the one who endorsed as a trade-off between him and the white man. We are going to release you, but what do you think of Dedan Kimathi?
And he signed for them to hang
While the international community was pressurizing the British government that this is not right, because you hadn't had proper case of this this man. You cannot hang a person who's holding a revolver, because then when he was taken to court, he was charged in possession of a revolver.
That was the charge, and the
possession of a revolver is up to date Kenyan law says that hanging sentence.
Possession of a revolver.
Mm.
Today still.
Still, you know, the Kenyan law is still the colonial law.
Mm-hmm.
Kenya law, like the Kenya Society Act, says that Mau Mau is a terrorist group.
Is Mau Mau still in existence today?
The Mau Mau are there. But according to the law, are not, you
legal,
see.
Right.
Mm. Kenya Society Act say don't join Mau Mau because Mau Mau is one of terrorist groups.
Is that a reason?
And that law has been there since the colonial era.
Okay. So they hanged Vidan Kimante on the charge of possessing a revolver.
And that is on 18th February 1952. And his body is still there at the Kamiti prison. Nobody knows where it is. So it seems as if Mau Mau is still serving long his life sentence. Because when they hang you, according to our old men, they tell us, when you will be taken to jail and hung all day, you die there, your people, your relatives will be called, will be informed that.
To come and get you.
Yeah, get your body back home. So the body of the Denki Mati is still there. 40 years during British, Kenyatta, Mwai Kibaki and Moi. Which means that African leaders are not our leaders. If they were sure they were really our leaders, they should have released the body of Dedan Kimathi.
Well, I want to just reiterate, we're about halfway through our program today, and we're really honored to be talking with Andrew Mungora. Am I saying your name right?
Mungora.
From Kenya, was an organizer, activist, has been a journalist and a union organizer on behalf of the Seafarers Association for African workers on the ships. And we want to really encourage our listeners to come out and hear Mr. Mungora speaking both in St. Petersburg and in Philadelphia over the course of the next week and a half. He will be at the Uhura House speaking at a public event on April 13th. That's a Sunday at 4 p.m. at 1245 18th Avenue South. For more information about that event, you can phone 727-821-6620. And then he will be speaking again in Philadelphia on Tuesday, April 15th at 7 p.m. at the Uhuru Solidarity Center at 3733 Lancaster in Philadelphia. And for more information on that event, you can phone 215-387-0919. This is a pre-recorded interview, so we're not able to take your phone calls or your emails on today. But we do encourage you to come and hear Andrew Mungora speaking in Philadelphia or in St. Petersburg in the next week and a half. In St. Petersburg, he will be joined also on the platform by Chernow Alpha Mba, the director of the Africanist Movement. So those are going to be really excellent events. So to get back to our discussion, more and more is being revealed, I think, now to the general public about the attacks, the real truth about European colonial invasion of Africa and the brutality that was carried out in the conquering of Africa. You mentioned the leases that were signed, but you know, as we know, similarly to in this country, in the U.S., the U.S. government has many documents that they say prove that they own this land or provide, you know, documents of justification for what they have done, you know, what the U.S. government and white society has done to both indigenous peoples here and taking their land and in the enslavement of African people. But, of course, those paper documents what stands behind those is the actual physical reality of the brutal slaughter and genocide of the people in order to steal the land. And I was wondering if you could share it all, let our listeners know about some of the conditions and the practices that were carried out, because I'm sure even though perhaps there were people who signed off on leases for land, but I'm sure for the masses of people who were being removed from their land that there was resistance and there was a physical taking of the land. And could you talk a little bit about the conditions of violence and brutality that were enacted upon the African people in Kenya by the British colonists?
According to what we heard from the old men, because most of us were not yet born, they told that the British were, you know, in the coastal region, the Portuguese were there. They were brutal. But our old men said that the British were more brutal than the Portuguese, and they are than the Arabs.
That the British were more brutal than the Portuguese or the Arabs.
And the Arabs, yeah. That's according to what they were old men giving us stories, what happened during that time. Although they say yes, sometimes they say it's far much better to be under white man rule.
They say what?
It's far, sometimes when comparing black leaders and the white leaders, they say it's far much better to be under white man rule. And we ask them why. No, we say, look here, when the white man was here, a shirt like this one was only 7 shillings. Now it is 700, you cannot buy it, we cannot buy it. Now it's more than 300 shillings, that's what they say. And they say during white man, water system was working, electricity system was working, there was running water, proper roads. But when the black man came to power, no black, no road, no water, no power, no nothing. That's why they compare. They say, yes, it was brutal, but the system was working well. You can go to a hospital and find medicine, get medicine, sometimes free of medicine.
And what is your response to that?
I say, yes. Yes, you can say that you are right by that time. But now we have our own leaders of whom you voted. You didn't vote for the white man. Now we have got our black leaders of whom you voted. Why is it better white man than black man?
Yeah.
So maybe mismanagement. So not mismanagement. These are the same white men in blackface. But the black men are greedy and nothing for the needy.
Well, I know the chairman has explained about neocolonialism, how the extraction of resources for white power imperialism does not diminish. White power imperialism still demands the same amount of resources, but then in addition to that, there is additional payment that must be paid to the neocolonialist sellouts to administer that system, so that, you know, for that reason, sometimes the conditions of the people, the extraction of resources becomes even greater.
Much greater. Like now, the Mozambique leader has signed agreement with the European Union, has given them fishing rights to fish in Mozambique waters for 15 years for only 900,000 euros for 15 years. Fishing rights.
To who?
European Union.
Oh, incredible.
That's Mozambican president, Chissano, and yes, I think it's Chissano. And other African governments are in the process of doing so. Kenya is a pipeline. And then also in the pipeline and other African countries. Somalia, there's no central government, but in Somalia there's also illegal fishing by European countries, fishing vessels, Western Japanese, Koreans, and it has been there since Siad Barre was there.
Since when?
Siad Barre, the president of Somalia, giving out fishing rights for foreigners to fish. Illegal fishing in Somalia is worth $96 million annually. And that man does not go to the local community. The man goes to Wallows and to European fishing companies, Japanese and Korean fishing companies, and Taiwanese fishing companies. And some goes to mafioso in Kenya, because they're part and parcel of that deal. So extraction of resources is going on there until you go for a long time now. like illegal mining is there in Congo, illegal logging is there in Congo as well in parts of Kenya.
We want to talk a bit further about the resources today and the struggle today and the unity of the need for unified Africa in order to achieve genuine reclaiming of the land and the freedom for African people. As Pastor Note, just to ask if you could say a little bit further about the conditions that were imposed on the people under British colonialism, under European colonialism, because we, in the Solidarity Movement, we're always trying to bring home to white people that we are charged with organizing to take a stand on the side of African liberation, to bring the truth and the horror of the brutality that have been faced by African people and other peoples in order to gain the comfortable life that we have come to expect and assume, and you know, as white people, whether we are in Europe or whether we are in the U.S., that you know, people like to turn a blind eye to what kind of violence and brutality is really necessary in order to create this comfortable life for us. What the reality is, you know, people want to turn a blind eye and not look at the truth. And so we're always trying to really put a human face and give the real reality of what people are suffering in order for us to be able to have the life that we lead. And we're just wondering if you could say a little bit more, because we've learned about the hangings by the Kikuyu, of the Kikuyu people by the British colonists and the European imperialists. I'm not sure if that was during the initial colonization or if that was in the repression of the Mau Mau and the freedom struggle. Do you know anything about that?
The hanging was not only on Kikuyus only, but some other tribes also were hung or tortured.
We read it was tens of thousands of people. Yeah. Was that in the same way that I believe it was King Leopold of the Congo would cut off the hands if people would refuse to go in the mines to work? Mm-hmm. Were the hangings for the purpose of to set an example
I think it's a part of they call it counterintelligence, something like that.
Of the what?
Counterinsurgence. Yeah.
So it was to crush the resistance of the people.
To crush the resistance of the people. Uh-huh. Mm, not only Mau Mau but other tribes. And they were not only targeting men but also women. Uh-huh. And for some stories were told by our old people say that they would used to take a bottle of hot water inside, put under the woman's private parts, so that they can speak out. Where is your husband? Mm. Mm.
So the torture that everyone is always so shocked that the United States would be conducting waterboarding in Iraq, but the history of European imperialism, the history of torture, the use of torture, is always been the method.
It has been there, the torturing of the white men torturing black man, and black man torturing black man, the system, see there, using it up to date. Because why did we run away from our countries? Why? Because we were done. For example, for Lucky, when Moi came into power, that is 78, under Nyayo House, there was a torture chamber, like what we had during Hitler's time. Hitler time.
Yeah.
In Kenya, there were torture chambers during Moi era. That is 79, 79, 80, 81, 83, 84, 85, 86, up to 2002. Mm-hmm. There were torture chambers down there.
Of the presidential?
President Moi, who is against him,
you
were talking there under torture chamber.
Yeah.
That's why most of us run away from the country. Uh-huh. And based in European countries or South African countries, where you may be free.
Yeah.
And keep on fighting by writing, doing this and this, letter writing campaign, organizing workers.
So now, today, you are part of the effort to build the African Socialist International. Can you talk about why it is necessary to unify Africa in order to achieve freedom and the reclaiming of the land for African people?
Thank you. When we grew up, we had, by that time, there were Haile Selassie, Kenyatta, Nkrumah, Nyerere, and others. So we were told about Organization of Africa Union. So we believe in Organization of Africa Union, but when I went to London and I met ASI, that's where they came out and tell me the true story. Organization of Africa Union is another thing, and Nkrumah is another person. This is what Nkrumah wanted, and this is what Patrick Lumumba wanted. So I took that story or that message back to East Africa. I target the youth. Look how, what the leaders, our leaders were fooling us around.
And how do you describe the difference between what Nkrumah, Patrice Lumumba, and the ASI are struggling for, as versus what the AU African Union is?
African Union is a useless organization. It's not for Africans at all. In fact, last week they invaded Comoros Island. What the American is doing in Iraq is what AU is doing in Africa. Uh-huh. Last year they invaded Somalia, capital city of Somalia, using the Ethiopian army.
So whose interests are the AU serving?
I think they're not serving us, yeah, Africans. They're serving somebody else, but not us Africans. Not at all. The way I see it. That's why we are trying to build up ASI in East Africa and Southern Africa. Our target is the workers and the youth to understand the clear picture, what is AU and what is ASI.
And then is your vision to remove the colonially imposed borders?
That's our aim. That's our aim. And I believe ASI will assist us, or ASI will do much better than other organizations in Africa. Than the Africa organization, Africa. Now they call it Africa Union. And I don't know what union they are talking about. Because, you know, in Rwanda, more than 500 people lost their lives. You was there. In Somalia now, it's 17 years. People are dying. You is there. In Sudan, Darfur. Children, women are suffering. AU is there. In Kenya, only 60 days, people fighting, poor against poor, AU came with force.
And when the AU comes in with military force, it is...
They didn't use
military... securing the imperialist resources.
Yeah. You know, Kenya is a launching pad of the white men in sub-Saharan Africa.
When you say launching pads, you mean military bases?
Yes, there's a military bases, and also apart from that, Nairobi or Kenya is somehow cool, where they can do what they want to do.
Okay.
So they don't want anyone to interfere with that. While you're in Nairobi, you can monitor what is happening in the Middle East. While in Nairobi, you can monitor what is happening in the Southern Africa region. While in Nairobi, you can monitor what's happening in West Africa. So they don't want anyone to interfere.
So it's a very strategic
place, yeah, for them. Yesterday, American ambassador told, you know, there's infighting between, yes, they signed a peace agreement between Mwai Kibaki, the president of Kenya, and Raila Odinga, now the prime minister, not yet prime minister, but the prime minister, he'll be appointed prime minister. The
of what country?
Kenya.
Okay.
You know, Odinga is a opposition leader. He got many votes against Kibaki. Uh-huh. But with support of white men, Kibaki's So people started fighting each other. The white men came quickly, oh, cool down, sign this peace agreement. What do you want? Condoleezza Rice say, went there and say, I think you need power sharing. Okay, okay, power sharing. Yesterday, the U.S. ambassador in Kenya say, quickly, please share power. Don't keep on fight. Because Raila wants his members of parliament to be cabinet minister. And Kibaki also wants his members of parliament to be cabinet ministers. Everyone wants to take a big cake. And we, the people are rioting Nairobi yesterday and day before yesterday and today, being tear gassed. Because people, the masses, they want a lean cabinet of about not more than 24 people. But because they want to take each and everything, they want a big cabinet of about 44 people. So your U.S. ambassador yesterday told them, please, quickly, appoint cabinet minister. We don't want to hear people riot in the streets again. Yeah. So Nairobi is an important place for for the European and Americans. Nairobi and Port Mombasa, or the sea coast of Mombasa. The coast of Mombasa is about 640 kilometers long, and we have 200 miles, not called miles, exclusive economic zone. And this is where you can find the American Navy, the British Navy.
What are they mining?
I mean, 200 not called miles, exclusive zone. Going down deep sea,
yeah.
This part of Kenya,
yeah.
Out there, we have the American Navy, the U.S. Navy, and the Royal Dutch, the Danish ships are moving around from Cape Gaddafi to Aden, Gulf of Aden, and to Persian Gulf. They have a base in Bahrain, Djibouti, and they might also have a base in Mombasa near future.
Africa is, the chairman keeps saying, Africa is the last final battleground for imperialism, all of the resources. You mentioned about all of the mines. I didn't understand, which mineral are they mining primarily? Which ore?
Oil.
Is it gold or? Oil.
I mean oil in Lake Albert, that is in Uganda. Oil, I mean oil in Lake Albert. And near future, maybe by the end of this year, in South Tanzania, near Mozambique border, that is known as a place known as Songo Songo. They have natural gas and oil also.
Is it mostly offshore or is it on the land?
Offshore.
Okay.
And Lake Albert is an inland navigation. In the border of Ugandan border and Congo border. And there's also north part of Kenya near Somali border. But I think by the end of this year also they will start also taking oil from that place. But the European, they want not take it right now. Hold on fast until there's peace in Somalia. So we don't know who is telling the truth. Because Kenya government say, we don't have oil. But the white men say there is oil. So we don't know. Don't get the truth. And there's illegal mining of diamond in Congo, and these deals are being done in Kenya. You know what they say? They say the killing of Patrick Lumumba was planned in Nairobi, Kenya. That's what they say.
So Kenya is very key.
Yeah, a key part of the white man for a long time.
Where are they talking about establishing AFRICOM?
AFRICOM, you are planning to establish in one of the 11 countries in the Gulf of Guinea. One of the 11 countries in the Gulf of Guinea. But I don't think if they'll do it. Maybe this will be done in East Africa. Maybe Mombasa. Mombasa, yeah. I think so.
So your target with the ASI is amongst the workers and the students. How will you proceed? What is the response being so far?
They are much interested. In fact, the students in Uganda and Tanzania, Tanzania has been a socialist country for a long time, since independence. But the form was, that socialist of Tanzania is different from the socialist of ASI.
Yeah.
So that's why the youth are much interested in that.
Okay. Now, since you've been over here in the U.S., how can you compare the conditions for African people, or what is your impression of the U.S.?
I think the U.S. is a cage. Yes, oh yes, I've been to 7 countries of the world. I've been traveled to more than 47 countries.
Yeah.
But I think U.S. is a cage. It's a big cage.
A big cage.
You cannot move here and there. There's no proper transport, public transport. If you don't have a car, you cannot move. So it's a sort of a cage. Because they want to move, but there's no train.
Right,
no
right.
Public bus. Right. You can stand there at the bus stop 1 hour waiting for the bus to come.
That's
so, you know, we need to move. You need to move to go where people are gathering. Here, there's no people gathering. Where to go? People, you sign a post there, police notice. Blah, 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 blah. Wherever you go, police notice. Blah, blah, blah. It seems as if it's a police state. I don't know, maybe because of the black community. I don't know. But for very parts of this place, I've been going. And police, private notice, police notice, blah, 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 blah. I don't know.
Now, in Kenya, we know the role of the big corporations and the mining operations and also the military. Could you say something about the role of the settlers? Is there still a large white settler population in Kenya, and is there any kind of solidarity from the white population there, or any kind of left movement, or what is the political view of the white people living in Kenya?
There's no big number of white settlers. I think there's less than 6,000.
Okay, so most,
and less, most of them went to South Africa and Zimbabwe. But they still control they still control the economy of the country.
Yes.
And they, you know, most of the industries, big farming, big farms, agricultural are under the white men.
So of the, you say 60,000 or so?
Not than 6,000. Not more than 6,000.
Not more than 6,000.
Because the coastal region alone is about 3,000 coastal region.
They're primarily the business owners or the owners of the large farms.
Farms. Yeah, in short, they control the economy of that country of Kenya.
Yeah.
You know, Kenya is the largest economic country in East Africa. They say, even Nyerere say, you want to go to Europe, go to Kenya. You want to go to New York, why you go to New York? Go to Nairobi. compared to Kenya and some other countries, other parts of Africa, Kenya, you can say, is developed in material by having high-rising building or skyscrapers, but not developed like our European countries. But compared to African countries. Compared to African countries.
So what do you anticipate for the future going forward for Africa?
You know, Africa, majority of population of Africa, majority about 69% is youth. So we are youth, young generation.
Yeah.
So we believe if we give more education to the youth, what is Africa socialism, true Africa socialism, maybe things will change. Because, you know, people are fighting in Africa, each other, but poor against poor. Because of little knowledge, I think, was what is happening, or the true picture. But if they get the true picture, they stop fighting each other. They know who is the enemy.
Yeah.
So let's target the enemy, not target another tribe.
Because
I'm poor and you are poor.
Yeah.
For example, the Kikuyus in Kenya are very rich people. And there are very poor people in Kenya, the poor tribe. The Kikuyus are the landless. The Kikuyu are the landless, jobless hawkers. You know, hawkers, street workers. Majority of street workers in Kenya are Kikuyus. Majority of prostitutes in Kenya are Kikuyus.